This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
And thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Leticia DeCagney and Eric Kirkendall discuss the Moving Forward Coalition's endeavors with regard to moving goods and the associated diesel fuel pollution with Richard Mabian. Also Nobel Peace Prize nominee and former host of the If You Love This Planet radio program, which aired on KKFI, Dr. Helen Caldicott will be in Missouri this week for a symposium on radioactive contamination. Gwendolyn Verhoff of St. Louis Community College will give us the details. But first, I'm Naturally with your headline news. EENews.net reports the Obama administration will rein in its budget request for U.S. EPA, but will propose an additional and separate $1.65 billion 10-year fund for climate infrastructure, according to the head of a national group that represents state and local air agencies. The new climate infrastructure money would be apart from an overall $8.27 billion EPA budget that will be unveiled Tuesday for fiscal 2017, said Bill Becker, executive director of the National Association of Clean Air Agencies. The top line $8.27 billion request would be more than the $8.1 billion lawmakers appropriated in fiscal 2016, but it would fall short of the $8.6 billion that the president wanted last February. Of the overall EPA budget, $268.2 million would go to state and local air pollution control agency grants, a $40 million increase above the fiscal 2016 spending level. $25 million would be set aside specifically for implementing the Clean Power Plan. Those figures match with what the administration requested last year. The budget would not include two line items Congress appropriated in fiscal 2016, $20 million for the targeted airshed grant program to address the five areas most polluted by ozone or average fine particulate matter, and $21 million for a multipurpose grant program. Becker lauded the president for recommending more funding for state and local agencies that implement EPA rules. ENN.com reports, new research shows that more than 5.5 million people die prematurely every year due to household and outdoor air pollution. More than half of deaths occur in two of the world's fastest-growing economies, China and India. Power plants, industrial manufacturing, vehicle exhaust, and burning coal and wood all release small particles into the air that are dangerous to a person's health. New research presented today at the 2016 annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences found that despite efforts to limit future emissions, the number of premature deaths linked to air pollution will climb over the next two decades unless more aggressive targets are set. Quote, air pollution is the fourth highest risk factor for death globally and by far the leading environmental risk factor for disease, end quote, said Michael Brower, a professor at the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health in Vancouver, Canada. Quote, reducing air pollution is an incredibly efficient way to improve the health of a population, end quote. New measurements from a NASA satellite have allowed researchers to identify and quantify for the first time how climate-driven increases of liquid water storage on land have affected the rate of sea level rise. A new study by scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and the University of California, Irvine, shows that while ice sheets and glaciers continue to melt, changes in weather and climate over the past decade have caused Earth's continents to soak up and store an extra 3.2 trillion tons of water in soils, lakes, and underground aquifers, temporarily slowing the rate of sea level rise by about 20%. The water gains over land were spread around globally, but taken together, they equal the volume of Lake Huron, the world's seventh largest lake. This study is published in the February 12th issue of the journal Science. And TheGuardian.com reports, a blowout at a natural gas well that gushed uncontrollably for 16 weeks and drove thousands of residents from their Los Angeles homes was plugged on Thursday, a utility said. The leak is expected to cost Southern California Gas Company, a division of Sempra Energy, at least $250 million, according to a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. While the well still needs to be permanently sealed with cement and inspected by state regulators, the announcement marked the first time the leak has been under control since it was reported the 23rd of October. The $250 million figure would could climb higher, much higher, because it only accounts for costs of capping the well and relocating about 6,400 families. It does not include potential damages from more than two dozen lawsuits, penalties from government agencies, and expenses to mitigate pollution. If the plug holds and all goes according to plan to seal the well, the upscale Porter Ranch community in the San Fernando Valley could begin to return to normalcy after schools were closed and about 6,000 families were uprooted as they complained of headaches, nausea, nosebleeds, and other symptoms as an intermittent stench wafted through the area. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Mike Murphy.
All right, thank you very much, Natural E. So as Natural E stated at the beginning of the program, Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and former host of the program If You Love This Planet that used to air on KKFI, is coming to Missouri this week. She'll be part of a symposium in St. Louis at St. Louis Community College called The Atoms Next Door on radioactive contamination. Also on that symposium will be Denise Brock, who has been on this program a couple times. Denise was featured in the film The Safe Side of the Fence by Tony West. And if I have my facts correctly, so is our guest that we have on the phone, Gwendolyn Wendy Verhoef. Is that correct, Wendy?
That's correct. It was an honor to be in that film, and I'm honored to know someone like Denise. So I appreciate your having me on this evening. Thank you.
Sure. So I got one of the press releases here you have, and there's apparently an art exhibit that's happening on that's called The Atoms Next Door, featuring Jason Hargrove's Contaminate St. Louis and Kristen Camuso's Humans of Westlake Landfill. So is this in conjunction with this?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it is. And thank you for mentioning that. So we actually, believe it or not, have three artists that are going to be joining us on the same evening that Helen Caldicott is coming. Chris Davis, who is the brother of Denise Brock and the son of the first ever Mallinckrodt claimant to win compensation from the federal government, will also be presenting some artwork for us. And so those three artists will be presenting their work. In other words, you can see it out in the gallery. Photography, prints, and pencil drawings for about an hour and a half before the panel discussion. And then Helen Caldicott will take the stage along with our panel of experts and be there to help the public with their questions about radiation and health.
So besides Denise and Dr. Caldicott, who else is on the panel?
Well, we have a few other experts joining us. Robert Alvarez, who is a columnist for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and actually a former advisor to the Secretary for National Security and the Environment in the 1990s. He's currently with the Institute for Policy Studies. He'll be joining us, and we have two of our councilmen from St. Louis County, Mark Harder and Sam Page. Both of them are very eager to engage with the public on some of the questions that they might have about radiation and the environment as well. And so we're excited about that. And we also have Ray Hartman, who is the founder of a very liked magazine in St. Louis, longtime journalist and commentator, who will be helping to MC for the night. And so we're just very excited about it.
So if anyone listening here in Kansas City is interested in going to St. Louis this weekend for this, what kind of information should they have? Is there a website we should direct them to? Or do you want to give dates and times and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So there is the St. Louis Community College website. That's www.stlcc.edu. And if you look right on that website, there is a campus calendar just to the right, and you can click on our event. And our event will be held on February the 20th, which is a Saturday, beginning at 5:30 and ending just after 9. And if you click on that little calendar notice, it'll take you to the webpage where you can RSVP. We are asking for RSVPs to help us plan for how much food and how many chairs we might need to serve our guests, but we're very eager to see anyone who'd like to join us. This will be the first installment of what we're calling the Making Knowledge Human series, and that's predicated on the idea that community colleges should serve the public and be a place for the public to come and have dialogue with experts and policymakers on questions that matter to them.
That's sounds really good. It sounds like a really noble endeavor. I understand Dr. Caldicott's coming in Thursday. So what does she plan to do between then and Saturday? Will she be touring Westlake Landfill and things like that in the area? Or
she's going to be visiting with members of the community and seeing St. Louis and seeing what Missouri is like. And so anyone who'd like to come and talk about Missouri at our event and bring their questions for her to discuss on the 20th, I'm sure she'd welcome that. So I think she's looking forward to seeing our state and all the different sites that we have, some of those related to nuclear weapons production here locally in St. Louis and in our region.
You know, I was talking to our friend Jane Stover earlier today, and she told me when Dr. Caldicott came to Kansas City, that is what inspired her to commit an act of civil disobedience to trespass at the weapons plant here. And of course, a lot of others followed suit. Over 100 people have been arrested in Kansas City. So Jane said if Dr. Caldicott can come halfway around the world to Kansas City, I can take my game up a little bit as well. And so she was very inspirational to the people in Kansas City and helped raise a lot of awareness while she was here.
Well, I'm glad for that. We're very, very proud and delighted that she'll be coming to St. Louis, and we hope that members of your audience and you would feel welcome to come and see her in St. Louis as well. She's won 21 honorary doctorates. She's published more than 9 books, as I'm sure you're aware. And I find it interesting, one of my favorite facts that I've learned about her in the course of getting to know her better is that the Ladies' Home Journal considers her one of the most important women of the 20th century. And I just think it's just wonderful that she'll be able to come and see us here in Missouri again.
If you get a chance to ask her, apparently she had gotten an audience with Ronald Reagan at one point, and just the two of them alone, I think Reagan's daughter facilitated that happening, and that's an interesting story. So if you get a chance, ask her that.
I will. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So anything else that our listeners should know?
I think that you've covered all the major points about our program. We will have future installments of the series. We're just very, very excited about the 20th. We'll have art, and we'll have a discussion of ideas, and everyone is welcome. And I think that's the most important thing, that if they have time and your listeners feel inclined, they should just drive right out to St. Louis and be part of our evening. We'd really welcome that.
All right. Well, that sounds great, and keep up the good work. And we did inquire earlier that there is a possibility that KKFI might get might record this for a future broadcast, or at least parts of it. I don't know, but we'll see.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But yeah, it sounds like a fascinating event. I'm sorry that I won't be able to attend myself, but sounds great. And keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to talk about it. I really appreciate that.
Okay, well, you have a good evening, and good luck with your event. It sounds like you got a busy week.
Thank you, and you have a nice week as well.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye. That was Gwendolyn Wendy Verhoff at the St. Louis Community College. Richard, before I turn it over to you, why don't we just knock out these first two spots out of the way?
Okay. On Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m., host Brian Noland interviews Peter Hoffman, staff attorney with the Legal Aid of Western Missouri, about Kansas City's abandoned housing crisis. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Aviva Chomsky on immigrant workers and the newspaper business on Counterspin, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's the year 2030. You touch a button on your phone and a driverless taxi pulls up and takes you where you need to go. Sound like science fiction?
It's interesting. It's actually quickly becoming science fact. A few decades from now, it could be commonplace for almost everybody to be driven by a computer-controlled car.
That's Jeffrey Greenblatt of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He says autonomous cars will likely improve safety and reduce carbon emissions, because computers drive more efficiently than humans. A computerized car can anticipate traffic and optimize its route and speed accordingly. It can accelerate and brake more smoothly, and it can follow other driverless cars closely, reducing wind drag. When used as a taxicab, Greenblatt says there's a strong economic incentive for the driverless vehicle to be electric.
Because they're much more efficient, and so they actually cost the company less to own and operate, and those savings can be passed on to the consumer as well.
Efficiency gains will also come from using the right size vehicle for each trip. He estimates by the year 2030, a driverless taxi could emit 90% fewer emissions per mile than the average 2014 gas-powered, privately owned car. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Good evening, everyone. This is Richard Mabian, and as usual, I'm glad to be here with you. You know, this is a tremendous time to be involved in the environmental and conservation world. I'm so thankful to be one of those persons that's out here on the front line learning and being able to come back and keep my city, my two cities and surrounding areas engaged and up to date on what is going on in America. In the last 3-4 months, I've traveled all over the United States from Dallas to LA to Washington, D.C., and just recently returned from Portland. So you can say I've been coast to coast. And each one of those trips had something to do with environmental literacy, learning about what people are doing on this planet, what they're doing here in America. There's so much I could talk about. If you did not hear of the Supreme Court decision to delay the Clean Power Plan project, then I would suggest you go to your computers and look it up. It's the first time in the history that the Supreme Court has ever got involved in a already passed bill and said delay it, basically based on what people with money, the industries, are saying is a problem. That's a precedent that is kind of scary as we look into places like Flint, Michigan, with the lead in the water. Big money could very easily put them in a position to get you an understanding of what happened, that the corporations and the responsible people in that part of the country could say, before we make a move on trying to correct what we've done, we want you to delay it, to give it another evaluation whether we should be considered responsible to do that. That's what happened last week with the Clean Power Plan. That's scary. So I'm glad that we're doing what we're doing. I will keep you informed more. It looks like it's one of those times for me to have a program where we come in and just talk about some environmental issues and concerns. I got a good one for us tonight. Tell you right now, take out your pencils and write down the number, because anytime that you feel you want to jump on the line to ask the question or include something in what we're talking about, please do so. Number here is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534, and I will continue to give out that number throughout the program. I'm sitting here with two of my very special people. They've been here before with me. We all make up an organization here in town called the Diesel Health Project. I'm here with Eric Kirkendall and my favorite person, Leticia DeCaney. Would you two say hello, please?
Hello.
Good evening.
Yeah, it's good to have both of you here. The three of us just returned from Portland. We were out there engaged with what is called the Moving Forward Network. And the only person at this table that's capable of being able to give you an explanation of the Moving Forward Network will be the person who got both Leticia and I engaged. So, Mr. Kirkendall, will you just kind of give us a brief blurb on what the Moving Forward Network is?
Yes, the Moving Forward Network is a national organization, national environmental organization, one of the few, maybe the only one in the country quite like it, governed from the bottom up by community groups, focuses goods movement transportation, that is freight transportation to most of us, making it safer for workers, communities, and residents, a big focus on air pollution as well as workplace safety.
Okay. Now, as you all know, I try to break it down in such a way that you all can get an immediate understanding, just like I just did with the court settlement, the Supreme Court ruling, how it compared to what was going on up in Flint. In this particular case, when we talk about the goods movement, our concern is the diesel emission that's coming from in California, the ports, where they're offloading those containers from ships, where you have your diesel trucks to come in and pick those containers up and take them to the various parts of the country. That is one of the main things we concern about, because it has been determined that diesel fuel, the emissions from diesel fuel, is a carcinogen, and carcinogens cause cancer. It had only recently. When did they make that determination? Do you know, Eric?
World Health, thank you, Richard. World Health Organization made that determination maybe 2-3 years ago.
See, that's how early it is. And you know good and well the way this country is as far as real news, with KKFI being the only station, I guarantee you, in this town, in this state, that will say anything to you about what we're telling you right now has only been a factor for 2 years. And if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. has yet to classify it as a carcinogen. Is that correct?
You're right on target. EPA classifies it as a probable carcinogen at this point.
Okay. Now, that's what we're dealing with. And the three of us are your lone representatives for being involved with this issue. Leticia, tell them a little bit about what we just went through in Portland.
Wow. I'm not really sure where to start, but it was amazing to be surrounded by other people who are passionate about, you know, the quality of life and the health of their community. And so with them being in the same room, we just are able to empower each other and talk about our pollutant impacts and solutions and, you know, a lot of success stories. And, you know, there's people that talk about their stories and why they're doing this. I didn't know if you wanted me to get into that yet.
Oh, we'll go there. Well, let's go with this. Eric, you can help us out here. Tell them about the various places around the country where these people come from at this particular point. I want to mention one, and that's New Jersey, because those folks up there are working for Governor Christie up there in New Jersey, and they were with us when he dropped out of the race, and so that was a big deal. But these people are working on the port where the ships and all the bridges and all that stuff is involved. I mean, big-time stuff. But name off some of the other places.
I sure will. Goods movement business in this world is international, of course, but goods move into the country via the ports on the coast. So we have membership from 45 organizations representing more than 2 million people, California, northern and southern California, Seattle, Oregon, the south as well, Houston, Kansas City, and growing rapidly to encompass more cities, and I've probably left some out.
Yeah, we got Chicago's in there. We got some folks from up in Detroit, even though they wasn't at this particular conference, but we got some folks in Detroit. Just about wherever you have ports,
railroads.
Now, that's where we're getting ready to go, because the reason Kansas City is involved is because Kansas City now is the largest inland port in the nation. Is that right?
If it's not literally true, it's probably going to be. BNSF Argentine rail yard is the second biggest rail yard in the United States. The BNSF intermodal, being built on the outskirts of Kansas City near Gardner and Edgerton, is slated to move well over 1 million containers a year. Kansas City is big and getting bigger. Afraid.
This is the reason that yours truly got involved. When I met Eric and he came in, as it is with most folks that come to this city with some kind of major concern about the environment, when they ask who is it that I should talk to, and my name somehow gets thrown out there, and that's how we end up meeting each other. But the thing that captivated my attention, and I'll just give it to you in a nutshell, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, boss, who I like to say is Warren Buffett, arranged some type of an agreement with the ports in L.A. that instead of them offloading containers coming in from China and to a congested port in L.A. and Long Beach, they would offload those containers to his trains. And he would then bring those containers from the West Coast all the way to Gardner, Kansas. Then trucks, your diesel-run trucks, would come from the four corners of this country. Of course, they put a limit of 500 miles, but you can forget that. Come from the four corners of this country and pick up those containers in Gardner, Kansas, and return them to their original destinations. Now, the reason that's an issue when I was just hearing about it was because when this is fully up and running, the truck traffic in the greater Kansas City metropolitan area has been stated to will increase to almost 20,000 trucks a day. 20,000 trucks a day. That's a lot of diesel emission.
That's new truck trips a day. That's a lot of trucks.
That's a lot of truck traffic. That is what got yours truly involved, because I knew then it was something that we needed to have some representation. From that, formed a group with Eric called the Diesel Health Project. You want to tell us about that?
I sure do. We set out after working for several years to make the new intermodal safer. We set out, and after it was built, we set out to be the canary in the coal mine. Very limited scope initially for Diesel Health Project. We were monitoring for air pollution from diesel trucks and locomotives in Gardner-Edgerton. And then under the leadership of Leticia DeCaney, sitting to my left, monitoring in Kansas City, Kansas, along the near the Argentine Yard. It was early in the life of the intermodal in Gardner-Edgerton. We didn't find problems. Leticia and her crew did find problems in Argentine, big ones.
You want to tell us about that, Leticia?
All right. So in our area, we had residents who allowed us to set this monitor out. So we set it out for 24 hours, did the testing. Long story short, those readings were showing that being exposed to the air for 3 hours can hospitalize you even 2 to 3 days after exposure. And we had some levels that were even higher that would even cause death. And, you know, that's something serious, you know, when it comes to our neighborhood. I mean, I live next to the rail yard since I was a kid. I mean, that's what would rock me to sleep. And I didn't even know about how dangerous diesel was until the Moving Forward Network just happened to come along and I attended a neighborhood meeting. And that's when I found out that, hey, you know, I know about this. I can't just sit there and do nothing. So that's when we started doing the monitoring.
Okay. I want to repeat something that she said. I want to make sure you heard it. In the monitoring that she was doing, there were, I understand, this is not a continuous flow. It's not like this emission is at that level 24/7. But during the 24-hour period that they were testing, they were able to catch that diesel level at such a point that it could, like for a 3-hour period, she said, end up sending people to the hospital with various respiratory type injuries and diseases. This is talking about one time now. And then they did a test, and the emissions were so high that if any elderly person had inhaled that emission, they could have possibly died in a 24-hour period. That is horrendous. That's here in our city. Unbelievable. I'm just amazing. I'm going to get out the number again just in case someone wanted to, like I said, make a call. That's 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Okay, Leticia, we formed a group called the Good Neighbor Group. You want to tell us what that's about?
Yeah, so the Good Neighbor Committee, we got together because what we wanted to do is fight for our community. We shouldn't have to move just because of our health, you know, and we shouldn't have to move because we don't feel safe in our neighborhood. And what we want to do is be a good neighbor with BNSF and have that relationship to be able to let them know, hey, this is how it's impacting us, and what can you do to help us? You know, it shouldn't be at the cost of our health that we have to, you know, suffer through all of this. I mean, there's so many people in our neighborhood that have illnesses that can, you know, be related to the diesel pollution. And, you know, that's one thing that we can do to help in the community is reduce the diesel emissions that come through the rail yard, mainly through the maintenance yard where there's a lot of locomotives idling.
Okay, another thing that Eric said that I want to bring up and to attach to this Good Neighborhoods group is that this is possibly one of, moving forward, Network is possibly one of the only organizations in the nation, environmental organizations in the nation, that truly starts from the bottom up. The Good Neighborhood meeting involves neighbors, and that's where we are right now as an organization in trying to organize and create that neighborhood group, to develop it in such a way that it can have a voice with the likes of Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. Okay, I got a thing here, Eric, that says, okay, what do we do? All right, I'll start it off. What can you do about it? Just like the group that's out in Argentina, we need to form those groups throughout the Kansas City metropolitan area. So again, I'm giving you the number, 816-931-5534, or look at the KKFI website, send us some kind of notice that you want to get in touch with us, and that way we can react to you. I'd like to see those neighborhood groups starting to form all over the city. This is just not an Argentine problem. This is a problem across the Kansas City metropolitan area. I think about my guy Jeff Humphill out there in the Northeast. This is a problem in the Northeast. In fact, I know for a fact right now there's some kind of major problem going on over there in the Sheffield area. I know for a fact that they're really concerned. EPA contacted me because my nephew's a pastor over there, and wanted to get contact with him because they need to drill into their parking lot to see if the groundswell up under the parking lot has received any of the overflow of some water issues that's out there with coming from the industrial area. This is not just an Argentine problem. It's across the whole metropolitan area. So we need to be in a position that you start learning about this and start associating with us and connecting yourself with it. That's one thing we can do from the neighborhood point. The other part has to deal with what we refer to as MOCAN Clean Air Coalition. Eric, you want to tell us about that?
I sure would. Thank you, Richard. One comment. If you live within a few hundred feet of a major interstate that carries heavy freight traffic, if you live near a large warehouse complex, or if you live near a freight yard, you may be receiving high levels of diesel exhaust. And nobody, almost nobody, measures it. So something to think about. Keep yourself safe. If no matter where you live in the Kansas City area and the wider metro area, if you're interested in this issue, we at the Diesel Health Project would love to talk with you. We need help. Our email address, info@mocanair.com, MOKANAIR.com. Please call. We are also, as Richard said, in the process working with other partners, including Kansas Chapter of Sierra Club, to set up a regional clean air coalition. Lots of urban areas have those. Kansas City doesn't. We are looking for nonprofit, health, recreational, community organizations to join with us. We're looking for folks to help us put it together. If that's something that interests you, if you'd like to be part of an organization that will allow all of us to speak with one voice when plans are made for things like the intermodal and when we find out we need to clean up places like the Argentine Yard, please get in touch. Last but not least, no matter where you live, visit right now. Pick up your, go to your computer or your phone, type in zeroemissionsnow.net, and please sign the national petition put together by Moving Forward Network, our national organization, urging the EPA to clean up ports and rail yards. We're getting a lot of traction right now. They're listening to us. Add your voice to that, please.
I want you to know that this the industries are already aware of the fact that this is a problem. I went to Texas's first energy conference last year representing the Kansas Sierra Club. And what they were talking about doing, because of this diesel emission concern, there are things that people are doing. One, using battery-operated cranes and offloading equipment at the docks. They're starting to do that. The Long Beach area has really improved their work as far as getting those kind of that kind of equipment on the docks. But Texas was talking about turning all of their diesel trucks into battery-operated trucks. And what they were claiming they was going to do is pick up the containers at the Gulf and drive them across Texas up 35 to Oklahoma and offload them in Oklahoma to whoever picks them up in Oklahoma to take them where they're going to go. So what they was concerned about doing is purifying their state. So I'm saying that's the type of circumstances that we're dealing with, just like up there in Flint. It's not going to be a national issue. It's going to be a state control issue. So if we don't have, and you know how it is here in Kansas and Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, if we don't have a community-based group of knowledgeable people, the decisions that's going to be made are going to be made without us at the table. And those decisions could be just like Texas. They're going to be taking care of themselves and not really being concerned about what's happening with people. Also, because of us doing this, Eric was able to secure a grant with EPA. We got an EJ grant out of the deal. All three of us sitting here are EJ grant people. Pretty cool. Want to tell them about that, Eric?
Yeah, I'd love to. Region 7 of the EPA did listen when the Argentine group came with their findings, and we applied for an environmental justice grant from them. They've announced that we'll get it, and we're nearing the time for them to sign the paperwork. But we're going to do four things with that grant. Number one, we're going to identify the communities in Kansas City, Kansas, four communities that are the most affected by diesel exhaust air pollution. We've probably been working in one of them, Argentine, but we're going to find others. We'd like to work with folks. So again, email, call this number now or email later, info@monkcanair.com, if you'd like to be involved. Then we're going to provide training on the risk of diesel exhaust air pollution, how you can reduce your personal and your family exposure, and how you can work together to make the community cleaner. We've got great partners behind us, including all the members of the Moving Forward Network that have been doing this for many years, and they're very good at it. We're going to have a lot of help. Third thing we're going to do is we're going to work with the residents of these communities to identify issues, develop a vision, not our vision, their vision, set goals in those neighborhoods for cleaning them up. Number four, we're going to develop collaborative relationships by working together with the through the MOCAN Clean Air Coalition.
Yeah, and I want to make it a repeat, as I said before. In fact, we just talked about this. This is so new. I mean, it's evolving as we sit here. And that's what I like about any type of project that I'm engaged in, because it gives you ability to take ownership for the decisions that's being made. I mean, this collaborative effort will truly be a collaborative effort. You heard Eric say that. It's not to tell you what you need to do, but to get your concerns and your feelings about what you would think need to be done engaged in this conversation so we can start representing you too, or having you represent yourself. By us extending our effort, we have the Argentine Turner Good Neighbors Committee going, and I'm sure we'll find ourselves picking up some in the other areas in Wyandotte County. I've already talked to the folks that live over on the Fairfax side of town that has plenty of diesel and trains and General Motors and everybody else over there that we can start monitoring and being concerned about. That's one of the things that we want to be able to do, is to come out and talk to your neighborhood group. You folks over there at All Souls, y'all need to get us over there for a meeting. You need to have a sense so we can tell people about this, because we're moving into Missouri. And Eric and I didn't really mention this or talk about this till we were sitting out there in the green room, that that's something that we wanted to make sure we said here on the air. We're ready to bring this, not just in Argentine, we're ready to take it across the entire metropolitan area. I mean, the intermodal is in Gardner. And I really think the people in Gardner, in Olathe, in Lenexa, should be concerned. In Lenexa, across the street from EPA, Amazon is building a horrendous warehouse. So when those products come in on the trains to Gardner, they will be transporting those products from Gardner to that warehouse. That means those trucks will be coming through Olathe, Lenexa. You didn't escape this one. And that's why I'm saying we need you listening to understand we need you at this table with us. We can't whip them. There's no way. I mean, can you imagine us whipping Warren Buffett? But there are things that people are doing. L.A. got some really great things going on out there. And we want to be able to duplicate what they have going on in L.A. They have a group of folks that are doing their frontline work that started getting involved when they were in the middle school. And that's where we want to go here. We want to be able to engage students in school so that when what happened in L.A., as those students grew up, they started taking environmental classes. Isn't that right, Eric? They started taking environmental classes and stuff, right?
Some of those folks have gone on to get PhDs and are teaching other students right now.
You understand? You got a group of folks out there 25 years old that are solid. I mean, every time I get around them, I'm so envious of them, because here in Kansas City, what do we have? Eric, Leticia, and I.
Oh, and a few others.
Well, they coming. They coming. You understand what I'm saying? But then you go out there, and here's a whole total population. Here's people that got those containers in their backyard. You know, when you got somebody that's got containers in their backyard that's a part of the group that's working to have something done about it, that makes a big difference. Schools. Do you know the intermodal they building out there in Gardner? They built it across the street from a elementary school. Makes no sense. Have they been fighting it? Eric Nimmons fighting it. We even had the group that I can't never pronounce the name, NRDC. What's that an acronym for?
National Resources Defense Council.
Now, the reason I haven't got that programmed in my mind, because we don't have none of them people here. But the Moving Forward Network has them. So us being associated with Moving Forward Network, we do have those people that are accessible to what we got going on here. In fact, the lady that's always speaking at the conferences came here to Kansas City, an attorney, and represented us where? At Topeka?
In the end, they worked with folks from Gardner-Edgerton, a local group, and they filed a lawsuit in federal court. And they were at a community forum we had in 2009 in Olathe. NRDC has really been here for us and lots of other communities.
Lots of other communities. Now, I want you to understand what he said. They filed a lawsuit. When?
About 2009, 2010.
About 2009 or 2010. All of you environmental-minded folks that are sitting out there listening to this program, did you know that? Did you know a lawsuit was filed out there in Gardner, Kansas, to try to prevent them from building that? Is that what they were doing?
They were trying to make it safer.
Trying to make it safer. Yes. And what happened?
They lost.
We lost.
That rail yard could have been put a few miles further down the highway, further from people. It would have been a lot safer.
Okay, gang. That's why I'm here. That's why the three of us are here. And we will continuously be coming back here, and we will continuously be asking for your support. We'll be continuously asking you to call in. We'll continuously ask you to see how we can get us in your neighborhoods, to have us come over and speak to your groups. This is going on. I talk to people, and I say, and you probably heard me say this the last time I was on the air. If you lived in Flint, Michigan, how many glasses of water would you have given your child or grandchild before you said, hey, something's wrong with this water? How many baths would you have raised, ran for your children before you would have said, you know, I don't know if I want to put my child in that water? Well, here we are, people, with a diesel emission problem in the Kansas City metropolitan area that's about to bring in 20,000 extra trucks a day, and the phone is silent. The phone is silent. I'm not criticizing anyone, because I think it's our job, I know my job in particular, to provide environmental literacy. If we're going to stand a chance in the future, that's exactly what we need to have. One thing that I've been trying to get a handle on is that they had some grants available up to maybe $1 million to install filters on schools. Filters on schools. Argentine has elementary schools, Turner has elementary, middle schools. The reason, because we're trying to filter the air that's coming inside the buildings. Isn't that what that's for?
Sure is. You're right on target. They've installed filtration on schools and hospitals in Riverside, California, and I believe in the LA area too.
And see, that started from the neighborhood. Don't expect the health department to come here and say, hey, y'all, I got some filters. You want to put them on your buildings? I've talked to all of them. I asked Burlington Northern. They had no idea where those filters even come from. Okay, I know I'm running off at the mouth, but there's some things I wanted you to hear, and I knew I could say it best over anyone else. We got about a minute or two before we got to go, and I want each one of you to give me something and take about a minute apiece and give me your final. Not quite a minute.
We can change the world, and you can help. Email or call.
Thank you for listening, and as Eric said, there is something that we can do. Now you know about it, let's do something about it. We shouldn't have to move just for our safety.
Oh, okay. Eric, you want to give me those numbers one more time? No, the numbers for the emails. Was getting touch
coming
with
right up. Yeah. It's info@mocanair.com. M-O-K-A-N, as in Mocan, and air.com.
Okay, group. Thank you again, as always. We'll be back, and we will continue, you know, as long as I'm alive and I'm part of this show, we will continue to bring you the best that we can to keep you informed, to help not only you, but your family. Thanks again.
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. I'm hoping you can join me this Wednesday, as my guest will be internationally acclaimed Irish recording artist Mundy. He'll be live in the KKFI studio Wednesday morning from 7 to 7:30. Don't miss it.
The 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
This year, we'll be live from the streets of Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on
KKFI from 6 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, till 8 a.m. Thursday, February 18th.
Improving water quality and herd health on this current cast. Manure and fertilizer runoff from farms is a significant source of water pollution, and that runoff can harm the health of the herd.
Water that's flowing in the stream can be a way for disease and parasites to move from one farm to another.
That's Lamont Garber of the Stroud Water Research Center. He says cover crops that prevent erosion, better manure storage, and trees between animals and water reduce the pollution and the health risk to a farmer's herd. But Garber says the real payoff for the farmer comes when
their kids can walk down to the stream and pull out a trout.
And that may be the most tangible evidence of all that the improvements are working. Support for Current Cast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Thanks for tuning back into Eco Radio. This is Natural Lee, and I have your environmental events. Vultures are often dubbed nature's cleanup crew and serve an important role in the ecosystem. Hosted at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, a presentation will highlight the many adaptations that allow vultures to be such a superb scavenger and how they help reduce the spread of disease. The talk will cover basic natural history and how these birds are faring in a human-dominated world, with a focus on the three species found in North America. This free event will be held from 7 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, February 16th at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center. And you can find more information on this event at our Eco Radio Facebook page. Inspired by Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, the film presents seven powerful portraits of communities on the front lines of the climate crisis, from Montana's Powder River Basin to the Alberta tar sands, from the coast of South India to Beijing and beyond. Interwoven with these stories is Klein's narration, connecting the carbon in the air with the economic system that put it there. Throughout this film, Klein builds to the idea that it's possible to seize the existential crisis of climate change to transform a failed economic system into something better. The Kansas Sierra Club is hosting a screening of this film. It will be on 7 p.m. on Wednesday, February 17th at the Glenwood Arts Theater. On February 19th through February 21st, at the Kansas City Convention Center, the National Pheasant Fest, it's an effort to help reverse the decline of the bobwhite quail since the 1980s. Quail Forever is hosting the nation's largest first ever quail summit on February 20th. You can find more information about this event also on our Facebook page. And then please join the Bridging the Gap for a buzzworthy evening to celebrate pollinators, listen to lively music, sip on bees' knees specialty cocktails, taste delicious pollinator-inspired food, and learn how Bridging the Gap will be helping butterflies and bees thrive over the next several years. Cocktail attire, winged references welcomed. There'll be a buffet dinner, 50-50 raffle, and a silent auction. And this event will be at the Hobbs Building on 9th Street. You can find more about each of these events I told you and their details on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page.
Two water crises you may not have heard about. That and other stories for the week ending February 14th, 2016.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
While attention has been focused on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, protesters recently went to Washington, D.C. in an attempt to highlight another drinking water problem, radioactivity.
The pollution is caused by about 15,000 abandoned uranium mines, mostly in the western U.S. and predominantly near where Native Americans live.
There never has been a comprehensive law that requires cleanup of all these abandoned mines. Companies that ran them have not been held responsible for remediation.
Last July, a resident of the town of Sanders in northeastern Arizona was told that he should no longer use the water on his ranch because it contained dangerous dangerously high amounts of the radioactive element.
The contamination extends beyond his ranch and into the community of Sanders. The town's school district draws water from wells where uranium is above safe levels, and now the district must rely on bottled water.
The problem occurs not only in tribal areas of Arizona. South Dakota has almost 300 abandoned mines that are contaminating waterways and desecrating sacred and ceremonial sites.
Charmaine Whiteface, a scientist and member of Clean Up the Mines, said her Ogallala Sioux community also experiences high cancer rates, and that she has found dangerously high uranium levels in their water supplies.
Last week, the Obama administration released its proposed budget for next year, and some might have expected a huge increase for funding of water infrastructure improvements given the disaster in Flint.
But the administration is proposing only a modest 1.5% increase in the drinking water fund, which helps municipalities improve aging infrastructure.
And even more shocking is the administration's plan to reduce the Clean Water Fund by $370 million. This fund is used to reduce urban runoff, improve wastewater treatment, and study the effects of unregulated chemicals in water.
Mei Wu of the Natural Resources Defense Council said in her blog that it makes no sense to cut funds to keep pollution out of water and then spend money to remove it once it's there.
Peter Gleick of the Pacific Institute noted that water challenges continued to be woefully underfunded, and he highlighted the distortion of spending $100 million on one fighter jet while cutting the Clean Water Fund by nearly four times that much.
And to put these water budget figures in further perspective, the Obama administration is proposing to spend $4 billion on driverless car research, but only about half that on water problems.
Between 1953 and 1987, nearly 1 million people serving at Camp Lejeune, the Marine base in North Carolina, were exposed to water contaminated from a host of toxins, including dry cleaning chemicals, vinyl chloride, benzene, and other petroleum products.
In what has been called one of the worst examples of water contamination this country has ever seen, many base residents have since developed severe illnesses, including rare cancers.
3 years ago, Congress passed a law requiring the VA to provide health care for affected Marines and their families. Veterans have expressed much frustration over how claims have been handled. A panel of, quote, subject matter experts who were put in place to review cases frequently denied claims without ever seeing the patient or their medical records.
In early December, veterans advocacy groups filed a Freedom of Information request for details about the identities and qualifications of the so-called experts in the review program.
Soon after that, VA Secretary Bob McDonald announced plans to expand disability benefits, making it easier for vets and their families to get care.
Veterans will now have presumptive status, meaning personnel are presumed to have been exposed to the contaminated water during their service.
Veterans Affairs officials recently determined that 15 diseases and conditions have been associated with exposure to the water, including numerous cancers, kidney damage, infertility, and liver disease, to name a few.
The U.S. Marine Corps is encouraging anyone who lived or worked at Camp Lejeune before 1987 to register at their website and spread the word to others who may have been affected.
About 150,000 penguins have died in eastern Antarctica since about 2010 because they've been landlocked by a giant iceberg that floated into a bay and blocked off their access to the sea.
A study by researchers from the University of New South Wales found that the birds have to waddle nearly 40 miles to find food.
One of the researchers said that the penguins that are surviving are clearly struggling to take care of themselves, let alone hatch the next generation.
The scientists saw a lot of dead birds on the ground and noticed that the area was eerily quiet compared to the past.
The penguins won't migrate to find other breeding and nesting grounds, so the researchers expect that unless the iceberg melts or moves, the entire colony will be gone in 20 years. And finally this week, speaking of penguins and ocean life, we all know that whales sing songs. For those of us of a certain age, that awareness came from the release of the Songs of the Humpback Whale in the 1970s that captured the public's imagination and led to the Save the Whales movement.
Although public awareness soared, exactly how and why whales sing is still a mystery. For humpback whales, for example, research has shown that songs are composed during breeding seasons and then shared across populations all over the Pacific, and each year it's a different song.
It's not the case case in the Caribbean, however, a new study shows that sperm whales from that sea share a distinct call that no whale from anywhere else makes.
In other words, Caribbean sperm whales have an accent. In fact, scientists have documented that sperm whales there sound different from ones in the Pacific.
And that's not all. These whales have specific sounds for their family units and even unique intonations for themselves. Names, if you will.
Like Bob?
Oh yeah, Bob Marley.
And the Wailers, of course.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn more at awwa.org/sustainable16. We're jamming. I wanna jam it with you. We're jamming.